From WNYC New York Public Radio, I'm Leonard Lopate. This is just one segment of the Leonard Lopate Show, but every interview is available on demand at WNYC.org. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC On Demand is supported by DataPipe Managed IT Services, delivering a comprehensive suite of managed services, including implementing, securing, and scaling applications designed for mid-market and Fortune 1000 enterprises. DataPipe.com.
You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Ever since Ronald Reagan took office, conservatives have hoped to change the direction of the Supreme Court. In her new book, Supreme Conflict, The Inside Story of the Struggle for Control of the United States Supreme Court, ABC News correspondent Jan Crawford Greenberg chronicles the conservative steps and missteps in their drive to move the court to the right. The book is published by the Penguin Press, and I'm very pleased to welcome Ms. Greenberg to my show today. Hello.
Hello, and thank you for having me.
By the time that Chief Justice William Rehnquist died, the Supreme Court had seven justices appointed by Republican presidents. So why were some of them reluctant to sweep aside all those earlier decisions that conservatives felt were just too liberal?
Well, that's, you know, been a source of endless frustration for the conservative movement because, you know, all these justices, seven justices, and yet this is a Supreme Court that refused to overturn Roe versus Wade, that refused to ban affirmative action, that struck down school prayer, that put greater limits on presidential power than ever before. In case after case, these justices disappointed the conservatives who had had so much hope that they would set aside these liberal rulings. And there are a lot of, you know, there are a lot of reasons for that. Some of the justices were mistakes. David Souter, the most liberal justice on the Supreme Court, or one of the most, was nominated by the first President Bush, George H.W. Bush. And, you know, he was never really conservative. Others changed when they got on the court. And one of the most interesting things that I discovered in doing the research is just how much these justices define themselves in relation to one another. You know, they're all independent justices. They all have their own offices, their staffs, their law libraries. They're almost like nine independent law firms, but they define themselves very much in relation to one another. So when a strong conservative justice like Clarence Thomas came onto the court with very strongly held views that year, that caused Justice O'Connor, the moderate conservative, to drift to the left. So you have that group dynamic setting going on, too, and that was fascinating to unearth.
You talked about the changes that some of the justices go through. John Dean told me that when he recommended William Rehnquist to President Nixon because they were looking for a conservative, he had hoped that he would adjust the way most conservatives do. And then he was disappointed that he remained true to all of the things that he had said before then, some of which John Dean thought were kind of crazy.
That's really interesting. And certainly Rehnquist always remain the steadfast conservative. Although Rehnquist disappointed conservatives at the end, too, because when he started out on the court, he was this lone dissenter and he really cared about the reasoning. In fact, his clerks gave him a little Lone Ranger doll, you know, to illustrate how he was just so willing to stand on his own principles, even if other justices didn't agree with him. But when he became Chief Justice in 1986, we saw Rehnquist start to not really moderate his views so much, but maybe some of the reasoning. And also, Rehnquist was not a Chief Justice, I've discovered through interviews and documents, who really tried to bring some of the other justices on board with him. He wasn't a Chief Justice to really push for votes, say, and votes he really needed, like O'Connor and Kennedy, the two moderates, the swing votes in the middle.
So how many of the justices did you speak with in preparing this book?
I was fortunate enough to speak with nine of the justices, and I spoke with scores of their law clerks, and then people inside the administration in the White House and in the Justice Department, and then up on Capitol Hill, because it's really almost two stories. You know, we have the first part of this story, which is looking inside the Rehnquist court, going inside those chambers, and how that court, which remember was together for, you know, a very long time, 11 years, the longest in history a court of nine justices has been together, you know, going into that court and seeing how it became that court, kind of surprising to some people, and then how those perceived missteps affected the Bush administration's thinking when it got a chance to put two justices on the court, how the Bush administration was determined to avoid some of those past missteps, or what conservatives saw as past missteps.
But would there have been a Bush administration if the Supreme Court hadn't been put into the position of deciding the 2000 election?
That is a case that, as we all know, deeply divided the court and the justices. It took the justices some time to get over that. But the conservative justices who were in the majority in that case, in that 5-4 deeply divisive case, they believed that the result would have been the same. The justice that I spoke with about that case, Justice O'Connor and Justice Kennedy, told me on the record that was not the best work of the Supreme Court. You know, they'd done it under intense time pressure. If they'd had more time, O'Connor told me, could we have done a better job? Probably. But they believe still that, and they look to some of the recounts that newspapers did in some of those contested counties, as O'Connor said, you know, even if we hadn't stepped in, the result would have been the same.
But hadn't the case been decided along ideological lines?
That is a point that I think you can look at and draw from the book, absolutely. And on both sides, you know, the liberal justices took positions that were at odds with some of their views in the past. You know, they kind of sided with the states' rights perspective. The conservative justices embraced this theory that the recount had to stop because it violated notions of equal protection, a stunning claim coming from justices like Scalia and Thomas and Rehnquist. You know, these are not justices that kind of create these new constitutional equal protection rights very often.
So why did the conservatives jump to join Kennedy's opinion if they disagreed with the reasoning?
One of the great untold stories, because they were so afraid that Kennedy, Anthony Kennedy, the justice who wavered in the past, who let them down in the past, was going to change his vote and go to the liberal side.
So Stephen Breyer thought that might happen, too.
He did, and so did David Souter. And they worked very hard to get Anthony Kennedy's vote, and they thought if they had one more day, maybe they would have gotten it. And the conservative justices thought the same thing, which is why Scalia and Thomas and Rehnquist signed on to that decision that, you know, embraced equal protection grounds instead of a separate one that Rehnquist had written, a more conservative decision. Rehnquist had written.
Had the conservative justices pushed for more judicial restraint in this case, or is that only something they did in other cases where they wanted to see a different result?
That case, they strongly believed that the Florida Supreme Court, as O'Connor told me, was, and this is a quote, off on a trip of its own. You know, and Kennedy said, we can't have a state court deciding a federal constitutional issue on a presidential election. It was a no-brainer to get involved in the case. But the liberal justices to this day believe that if the parties had been reversed, if it had been Gore versus Bush, for example, that the conservatives very well would not have gotten involved in that case in the first place.
My guest is Jan Crawford Greenberg. Her book, Supreme Conflict, The Inside Story of the Struggle for Control of the United States Supreme Court. It is published by the Penguin Press. And we shouldn't be surprised that a certain political party, whatever political party, would want to control the Supreme Court. After all, FDR tried to pack the court. So why wouldn't somebody want to have as many sympathetic justices as possible?
Well, and particularly as the court has taken on some of these contentious social issues that, you know, divide society, you know, abortion, gay rights, church and state. I mean, the court has taken on more issues than it had, say, 100 years ago. And so that has caused Republican presidents, particularly since President Nixon, to really try to change the court, to try to scale back or overturn some of these landmark liberal rulings of the Warren Court. But as we saw over the years, Republican presidents were really unable to do that for a whole bunch of different reasons until very recently when George W. Bush nominated John Roberts and Sam Alito.
So why were there the missteps in the past? Were they just, did they not vet people like Souter as well as they might have liked?
Souter was one of those kind of classic examples of disconnect at every level. George H.W. Bush wanted a nominee very quickly. Everyone in the White House assumed the nominee was going to be, if you can believe this, and it's almost hard to even contemplate today, was going to be Kenneth Starr, who was President Bush's Solicitor General. Obviously, that was well before his prosecution of President Clinton in the Whitewater investigation. At that time, he was considered a first-rate, affable judge who had gone into the administration with the promise that, you know, yes, yes, he was at the short list. I mean, nothing was promised, but the understanding in the White House was that Starr was going to be President Bush's first nominee. But Starr had some enemies in the Justice Department, and they believed, again, this is almost incredible to realize when you think about who Bush ended up nominating, they did not think that Ken Starr was conservative enough to be on the United States Supreme Court. Starr, they believed, was meandering, and some of his briefings were verbose, and they used words like squishy, that he was analytically unfocused. So their fear was that if Ken Starr was nominated, he was going to drift to the left, just like Anthony Kennedy, just like Sandra Day O'Connor, they believed, had done. So they argued that they could not nominate Ken Starr. Attorney General Dick Thornburgh very strongly just kind of laid a line down in the sand during a meeting with President Bush and his top advisors, said Starr's out. And so from that moment on, there was this conflict, this vacuum, and that allowed this unknown, untested figure from New Hampshire, who was obviously the led by John Sununu, to go in and get that nomination instead of Ken Starr, which, of course, as we know, Souter is now one of the most liberal members of this Supreme Court.
And can we really say that Kennedy and O'Connor drifted to the left? Or haven't they stayed kind of in the middle and voted with both sides according to how they perceived the case?
There's a couple different answers for that. I think, yes. I mean, Kennedy was also, there were many lawyers in the Justice Department back when President Reagan nominated them who believed he wasn't conservative enough either. And they went and mounted this incredible campaign to sabotage his nomination. And they were successful at first. After Robert Bork's nomination went up in flames, they were able to get another nomination out there by a series of maneuvers to block Kennedy. They thought he was not going to be conservative enough. So that wasn't so much of a surprise. And O'Connor, too. I mean, she always saw herself, former state legislator, she always saw herself as a more moderate, balanced person. But there is also no question that they did change their views in some areas. And certainly academics have written that the court, particularly in the last 5 or 6 years, gradually became more liberal. And they speculate that that was in response to Bush versus Gore, because O'Connor and Kennedy, after that controversial decision, didn't want to be seen as being predictably and obvious votes for the right.
So do justices really have their heads turned by the reactions of the press and the public, as some conservatives allege?
I think that, as Chief Justice Rehnquist wrote back in the 1980s in a series of articles, of course justices are influenced by the tides of public opinion. They're human like anyone else. And so, you know, why not? And some justices very actively read what reporters write about them, but others don't. Justice Thomas, for example, doesn't read what people write about the Supreme Court. I mean, he reads the papers, but if it's something about him, he consciously avoids it.
At one point, you used the fox and the hedgehog comparison that Isaiah Berlin used in one of his essays to describe the justices.
I think it's just an interesting, you know, a hedgehog knows one really big thing, whereas foxes know a lot of little things. And so, you know, that's a way of thinking about the Supreme Court, too, and there's a place for both. A hedgehog is someone like Antonin Scalia or Clarence Thomas, a strong, clear point of view, one big thing, whereas the foxes would be like a Stephen Breyer or an Anthony Kennedy, lots of different things, seeking consensus and compromise. There's a place for both of those viewpoints on the court.
And O'Connor was the one who wrote the majority in Hamdi versus Rumsfeld that granted Guantanamo detainees access to U.S. courts.
Absolutely. And again, shows the enormous influence of Justice Sandra Day O'Connor and how the court now, with a solid judicial conservative taking her place, is poised to go in a very different direction on issue after issue. Presidential power is just one. We have abortion. You know, we've got criminal issues that Justice O'Connor cast the deciding vote. So this court, with these new justices, is poised to go in a different place.
But wouldn't that decision granting access to the courts have been seen as a conservative position in another time, and giving the president more power be seen as a liberal position at another time? Has everything flip-flopped?
You know, that's a fascinating question, and I just can't answer that. I mean, I don't know how. I mean, the conservative justices on the court today would say, of course not. They believe they have a very strong view of the law that's grounded in just looking at the text of the Constitution. The liberal justices would take the opposite point of view. I think that's almost an impossible question to answer. But the point of that case and others is that because this court has been so closely divided over the years on these contentious issues, it's now ready for change with these new appointees.
My guest is Jan Crawford Greenberg, a correspondent for ABC News who covers law and politics for World News Tonight, Nightline, Good Morning America, and This Week with George Stephanopoulos. Previously served on as a Supreme Court analyst for the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer and on Face the Nation on CBS. And she's written a book called Supreme Conflict, the inside story of the struggle for control of the United States Supreme Court. It is published by the Penguin Press. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Jan Crawford Greenberg of ABC News. She's written a book called Supreme Conflict, the inside story of the struggle for control of the United States Supreme Court, published by the Penguin Press. Why do you say it was a mistake for the Reagan administration to nominate Antonin Scalia before they nominated Robert Bork?
They were in a position where, Scalia was nominated alongside Chief Justice William Rehnquist. Rehnquist had been on the court, so they just moved Rehnquist into the center seat and then nominated Scalia to replace him. Rehnquist was such a controversial figure. Everyone focused their sights on him. And Scalia, who was this gregarious nominee, the court's first Italian-American, widespread support, slid right under the radar unnoticed. He was confirmed unanimously. So had they then nominated the more controversial Bork, he could have been confirmed alongside William Rehnquist, saving, Scalia's charm and personality and being the first Italian-American for the next nominee, because by the time it came time for Robert Bork, the Republicans had lost control of the Senate. It was a very different time.
And Scalia had turned out to be very conservative, so they were afraid that Bork might be another Scalia.
Right. And in fact, one of the interesting things I found in doing my research in some of the presidential libraries was that advisors at the time, they thought that Scalia and Bork were almost identical, although some believe that Scalia was more conservative than Bork, which certainly was not how Bork was portrayed when it came time for his nomination.
And then there was the nomination of Douglas Ginsburg.
Right, and that was as a result of some of the ardent opposition by lawyers in the Justice Department to Anthony Kennedy. After the Bork nomination went up in flames, Anthony Kennedy was the presumptive nominee to go next. But these lawyers, again, felt very strongly that Kennedy would not be a predictable conservative. So they were able to persuade President Reagan to nominate Douglas Ginsburg instead, because they believed that Douglas Ginsburg would be that reliable conservative. And of course, as the great Nina Totenberg reported about marijuana use in his past, his nomination quickly fell apart. And by that point, Kennedy's opponents really had nothing left in their holster. They just had to bow down and concede it was Kennedy's time.
Now, if Nina Totenberg could discover that Ginsburg had smoked grass when he was younger, how come the people who were vetting him for the president couldn't figure that out?
The questions were different then. The questions have changed. The vetting process has changed, as we've seen the confirmation process change. So when they asked Doug Ginsburg if he'd ever abused marijuana, he truthfully said no.
And today, by the way, there would probably be a different response. We've had couple of presidents
Sure.
who've admitted to smoking marijuana.
Sure, it's a different time, but I can tell you the questions changed very quickly. Anthony Kennedy, the next nominee up, was subjected to about 3 hours of questioning by FBI agents, and they asked him those extraordinarily intrusive personal questions that you can possibly imagine. Questions about, did you abuse drugs, but did you ever even think about using drugs? Even questions about his sex life, even his sex life with his wife. So by the time Kennedy got through the vetting process, the White House felt very confident that they had left, no stone unturned.
Well, there were these two failed nominees in the case of the Reagan administration. Did the present President Bush make a similar mistake when he nominated White House counsel Harriet Myers?
No. I think the Myers nomination we have to look at in comparison to the Souter nomination. George Bush, George W. Bush, was seared by his father's mistake in nominating David Souter to the Supreme Court, and he was determined not to repeat it. You know, George H.W. Bush didn't know David Souter. His advisors, Sununu and that bunch, told him that Souter was going to be a conservative, he was going to be a solid vote for the right, and, you know, that lasted, what, no time. I mean, by the time Souter got up there, he was almost as liberal as the justice he replaced, William Brennan. So Bush was determined not to make that mistake. He knew Harriet Myers. He thought Harriet Myers was conservative. He believed Harriet Myers would not change. That's how Bush ended up tapping Harriet Myers. Now, ironically, the opposition to Myers was, of course, not from the Democrats, but from the conservatives, and they opposed her for the same reasons. Again, David Souter. So both sides were guided in that nomination by the Souter nomination. The conservatives revolted because they thought she would change. She wasn't smart enough. She didn't have a legal theory. And once she got up on the Supreme Court, surrounded by intellectual heavyweights like Stephen Breyer and Ruth Bader Ginsburg, she would go to the left just like some of those other justices they felt had let them down in the past.
Didn't their reaction undermine their complaints about Democratic opposition to nominees on ideological lines? Or didn't that matter?
Their opposition to Myers was that she was not qualified, that she was too close to Bush. I mean, some of the things, you know, she was a crony, and the more her qualifications became evident, and then the frankly less impressive her qualifications obviously became, you know, the closer she seemed to Bush, the more relevant charges of cronyism came to Bush. And one of the interesting things, I think, about how the Myers nomination even came about is that the one high-ranking administration official who raised the most serious concerns and actually tried to persuade President Bush not to nominate Harriet Myers was the one official who had been most vilified by conservatives. That's Alberto Gonzalez. You know, liberals, Democrats, when we think of Alberto Gonzalez now, you think about his positions on the war on terror and the torture memos. But conservatives in the early days of the Bush administration were afraid that Bush was going to nominate Gonzalez to the Supreme Court, and they thought he wasn't conservative enough. So when Gonzalez learned that Bush was seriously thinking about nominating Harriet Myers, his advisor said, you've got to do something about this. And he was reluctant at first because he didn't want Bush to think it was about him, you know, his own nomination. And so his advisor said, no, I mean, the conservatives will revolt. You've got a duty. You have to do it. And Gonzalez realized he did. He went to the White House. He laid out his concerns to President Bush, but it was too late. Bush had already decided to nominate Myers. He didn't listen to Gonzalez. And of course, as we know, at the end of the day, Gonzalez was precisely right.
Although that was also considered a woman's seat on the Supreme Court, and that changed when they decided to nominate a male for the job. My guest is Jan Crawford Greenberg, who's written a book called Supreme Conflict, The Inside Story of the Struggle for Control of the United States Supreme Court, published by the Penguin Press. What about Clarence Thomas? He's got a reputation for being rather unintelligent and going along with whatever Antonin Scalia votes for because, among other things, he asks so few questions during oral arguments. Is he misread?
That is one of the most fascinating things that I unearthed in my research at the Library of Congress. I went through the papers of Harry Blackmun and found conclusive documentary evidence that shows that storyline is patently and demonstrably false. In case after case, from Thomas's first week on the court, he was willing to stand alone, to be the sole dissenter. He'd send around his dissents to the other justices as is custom. And in case after case, justices would change their votes to join him, particularly Justice Scalia. So if any justice was persuading the other, causing the other to change their votes that year, the first year and on, it was Thomas persuading Scalia, not the other way around. I found that to be the most vivid and startling bits of research that I uncovered.
Had he been hurt at all by what had happened in the Anita Hill hearings?
You know, the people that I've spoken with about why this is and, you know, why Thomas got this rap, this really false, you know, view early on was that, you know, they think it was lingering a bitterness from the confirmation hearings, the rancorous nature of those hearings, and in some said his testimony during the hearing, so that when he came on the court, you know, people were just in no mood to give him any kind of a credit for doing anything at all and just would assume that, of course, he would follow Scalia, who was obviously considered this dazzling intellect on the Supreme Court. But as I saw from the papers and the documents, and Harry Blackmun took incredibly detailed notes, they're just a treasure to go through. When the justices decide cases, they go in a private conference room and they all sit around a table, and each justice speaks once before any of the other justices can talk. And there's no one else in the room. It's just the justices, no secretaries. And Blackmun recorded not only those votes taken, but the very detailed notes about what the justices said. And so you can get a sense of what the positions were during those conferences, and then which justices would be persuaded, you know, weeks or months later when opinions started circulating. And those votes, and then when you see those opinions coming down later, would show that Scalia was changing his vote to join Thomas, starting with the first week that Thomas joined the court.
Now, Blackmun started off as a much more conservative justice than he became. And I wonder about his personality in Sandra Day O'Connor's first years on the court. Hadn't he rubbed her the wrong way and perhaps affected the way she voted?
That's a really interesting point. And he did. I mean, Blackmun was not one of the more well-liked justices. He was considered very prickly. His law clerks did quite a lot of work for him, more than some of the other justices. And he had grown over the years. Obviously, he was proud of his decision in Roe versus Wade, and he had become quite defensive of that decision. He really became so focused on that one decision and how it was interpreted, how he was viewed. He got enormous amounts of mail about it, and he kept them all. He saved every one and cataloged many of them. But Justice Blackmun and even Justice Brennan, the liberal great justice who wielded enormous influence during his long career on the court, rubbed Justice O'Connor the wrong way. And that cause, those two liberal votes, kept Justice O'Connor in her early years on the court from going to the left. They were kind of this reverse force field. And so once Justice Brennan stepped down in 1990 and Justice Souter came on, that was gone. That strong Brennan presence on the left was gone. And remember, O'Connor sees herself as this balancing, moderate person. So with Brennan off the court, and then when Thomas comes on the next year with these strong conservative views, there was not that force field to keep O'Connor from going to the left. And that affected the dynamics of the court quite dramatically.
But now that Roe v. Wade is 34 years old, some people say, well, it's this conservative court has kept it in place nonetheless. But haven't they really eaten away at it? Hasn't it been nibbled away to a point where eventually it can be made into something that has little effect, even though it won't be totally overturned?
Not yet. The court under William Rehnquist put Roe on more solid ground in 1992 in a decision we call Casey. And over the years, really refused to allow any substantive restrictions on abortion, including just as recently as a few years ago when the court, in a 5-4 decision, with Justice O'Connor, of course, casting the deciding vote, struck down state laws that banned a very rare procedure people call partial birth abortion. Now, see, now we've got that case back. There's a federal law this term. There's a federal law at issue. The court's already heard arguments on whether or not the federal government can ban that procedure. And with a new justice on board, Sam Alito, the court is poised to go in a very different direction and do just what you said, start chipping away more at Roe so that, you know, whether they overturn Roe or not, you know, they will start allowing more restrictions on the procedure itself.
Is it just Samuel Alito? Wouldn't John Roberts also have effect?
Yes, but Roberts has not suggested that anything in his background or in his votes to this date to suggest he would not vote, any differently than William Rehnquist did, the man he replaced. So the key vote here, assuming that Roberts would vote like Rehnquist did, to allow these restrictions on abortion, the key vote here would be Sam Alito. And again, there's nothing in Alito's background and his previous decisions to suggest that he won't be conservative either.
Now, how was Samuel Alito, a nominee who was on record as opposing abortion and as being a staunch conservative in almost every respect, able to be confirmed by a Senate that had earlier threatened to filibuster?
And Democrats have been enormously successful in filibustering President Bush's appellate court nominee, so there was a real serious effort and chance that Alito would be blocked. And certainly going into his hearings, the groups on the left that opposed him were very confident that they were going to be able to persuade the Democratic senators to stand firm and block Alito's nomination. They had the smoking gun. You know, they had memos that showed Alito was on record saying that he thought Roe versus Wade should be overturned. I mean, that's about as good as it gets. So they were very confident that they could block Sam Alito. But Sam Alito himself, his performance in the confirmation hearings sealed his confirmation itself. He was an incredible witness. Everyone talks about what a great witness John Roberts was. You know, he was smooth. He explained the law, you know. But Alito, he came across as this earnest, shy, quiet, respectful lawyer, and the fight just went out of the room. It was like, you know, when you're trying to strike a match, you know, on a smooth surface, and if nothing's there, you're not going to get a fire going. And the Democrats were unable to do it, and they just folded their hand.
What can we learn from the decision earlier this week, the Supreme Court decision that overturned California's sentencing guidelines? It was 6-3 decision that cut across ideological lines.
I think the main thing that we can take from that is that there are always going to be cases that split the court in different ways. You know, on the key social issue cases, we think of this court and the past court as one that's divided 5-4, conservative, liberal. But there are always going to be cases you'll see an unusual lineup of justices, particularly in the criminal area. And so that's something that I guess is important to keep in mind. It's not always 5-4. And these justices, even the conservatives, say Thomas and Scalia, they vote alike. Very, very often, but sometimes they part ways.
Your book gives an unusual look into the inner workings of the Supreme Court. Why were your sources willing to discuss what's usually a very isolated and insulated institution?
I just feel so fortunate that they did. I've covered the court for 12 years, and I got to tell you, I mean, they didn't talk to me the first few years when I started covering it, you know, but I guess after a few years and they kind of grow to trust your coverage and see that you're fair. Conservatives and liberal justices all agreed to sit down with me. So I feel just incredibly fortunate, actually, that they were willing to talk to me so that I could tell what obviously is an incredibly important story. I mean, this is an institution that determines decisions of enormous importance to American life that affect all of our lives. And it's a court that's very narrowly divided on these things.
Jan Crawford Greenberg's book, Supreme Conflict, The Inside Story of the Struggle for Control of the United States Supreme Court, is published by the Penguin Press. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening to the Leonard Lopate Show from WNYC, New York Public Radio. You can hear everything we do and check out our other programs on demand at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.